You're listening to Tech Talk Radio in your backyard and worldwide on the pod.
Every once in a while, a revolutionary product comes along that changes everything.
It's the first time that Apple have actually decided to tell people about something that they're developing.
High-speed broadband, let's just make sure that we can get it in Australia this year, not next.
The three main spamming countries are the United States, China and South Korea.
And I've got some residual powers.
Sounds like something out of Harry Potter.
Senator Coonan, the voice of reason.
There's a couple of systems on a gantry that's actually based on a military missile tracking system.
You put the date on ePray and you get a whole service just on it.
How does it go?
IE7, you were having trouble installing it because you had a genuine copy of Windows that wouldn't validate properly. What did you have to do to get past that?
Built a new machine.
But how hard can it be?
Well, it's not hard at all.
At the end of the day, the photography is all about the person's eye and what they see.
If you find something that's inappropriate about your child, you need to do something about it because it will not go away.
On air, on the internet and on the pod, you're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the second last installment of the Tech Talk Radio Summer Series. I'm Andrew McComb, and just to let you know that the crew is well rested and looking forward to the first show of 2008 in the first week of February. In news this week, the scheduled turn-off of Telstra's CDMA mobile phone network is still on track for January 28. And the spin is certainly ramping up. Jeff Booth, Telstra's countrywide manager, has certainly been spruiking the airwaves the past few weeks. He said there are now twice as many NextG base stations, some 6,000, as compared to that of the CDMA network. With less than 2 weeks to go before the scheduled closure of CDMA, Telstra is urging customers to ensure they aren't still inadvertently using the CDMA service. Brett Riley, Telstra's countrywide executive director.
So after the 28th of January, CDMA phones won't work anymore. So it's really important for customers to check their phone, see if it's a CDMA phone, and you can easily do that by taking the back off the phone and seeing if it has a SIM card. If there's no SIM card in there, then it's a CDMA phone and you'll need to upgrade to NextG before the 28th of January.
The new Communications Minister, Stephen Conroy, has it all before him, and it looks like his advisers are just as off the money as his predecessors. While we've all been on our summer break, the notion of compulsory internet filtering by ISPs has raised its ugly head again. Despite the fact that Stephen is new to the portfolio and is keen to take a high moral ground, this just isn't as simple as you think. We all moan and groan about the lack of speed in this country. Well, this definitely won't help the cause. The panel will be back to discuss this and the other goings-on in the past 6 weeks in 2 weeks' time. Now for tonight's show. How important is a good-looking website these days? The answer is very. Did you know that 75% of web users admit to making judgments about the credibility of an organisation based on the design of its website? And 83% of businesses use the internet to search and find potential vendors. If that doesn't surprise you, then count yourself amongst 75% of web users. Last year, we spoke to Lance Loveday and Sandra Niehaus, authors of a new book, Web Design for ROI, or Return of Investment. Based in Sacramento, California, Lance and Sandra walk us through the right things and wrong things to do when building that perfect website. Whether you're a CEO of a large corporation or just rebuilding the website for the local footy club, this is Must Listen Radio. Also, we catch up with Julia Sinkovich, Senior Product Manager of Windows Server Division of Microsoft from their US headquarters. Julius will run through the new Server 2008 technology as Server 2003 gets its makeover. Julius started working in information technology in 1991 and has held various positions in systems and network administration. In 1998, he joined Microsoft as part of the Microsoft Consulting Services Group and worked with some of Canada's largest companies deploying infrastructure servers. In 2000, he moved to Redmond, Washington and worked with Microsoft Learning and Tablet PC Groups. So stay with us for the second last show of the Tech Talk Radio Summer Series.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Alrighty, let's talk about websites. Have you guys built websites, no doubt? Have you built them with all the right things in mind is the ultimate question. I recently caught up with Lance Loveday and Sandra Niehaus, authors of Web Design for Return on Investment.
Congratulations on Web Design for ROI, a topic which is near and dear to my heart.
What was your inspiration for the book?
It was a bit of frustration, actually, in that so many clients that we dealt with over the years just didn't appreciate the potential value that they could get out of their website. And we kept having to educate clients again and again on the same types of topics. And it came to us over time that, well, perhaps we should think about writing a book. And fortunately, we're approached in the same time frame by a publisher, so it was a fortunate confluence of events.
So what's your background in web design? Do you guys do it professionally?
Yes, I've done it professionally since about 1995. I have a background in programming that goes back to, I hate to say it, back to the early 80s. And and once I had been some pass through the music field and teaching and various other interesting career moves, I moved into web design and web programming. So I've been doing that since the early 90s.
Consumers are more web savvy now than they have been in any other time in history. What are they looking for in a website when they're researching, say, for example, their next purchase?
Well, they're looking for ease of use, for one thing. And it's amazing to us how people's habits have evolved and they've gotten more sophisticated over time. But they're looking for, you know, in large part the same things they always have. And that comes down to ease of use, intuitiveness, the right product information at the right time, reassurance that the entity that they're dealing with is credible, that their website is secure, all of these things.
You mentioned credibility there. How important is a company's website when it comes to building and maintaining their credibility and, importantly, their reputation?
Oh, it's in this day and age, it's especially important as more and more people, even if they don't end up purchasing online, they still go online to research a company and research a product. So, and even business to business and people hiring other vendors and employees, they go online to research that company and the person. So, and it's been shown in research that within the first 1/20th of a second when someone arrives at a website, they have already decided whether that company is professional, whether they're credible, and whether they want to continue to interact with that company. So that's not enough time for them to read any of your great copy or look at the design of your website. At the navigation of your website. It's only enough time for them to get that instant hit from the design. So the design is really crucial.
On page one of your book, Sandra, you've got 75% of web users admit making judgments about the credibility of an organization based on the design of its website. Is that only going to improve?
I think that number, yes, will increase as more and more people become familiar with the web and more people begin to use it to research companies and make sure that they're legitimate. There's still quite a large number of people that have not yet come online, or if they do come online, they don't spend much time there. So the potential for the web to provide information about companies and about products is still largely untapped.
If anything, I would say that number is understated. That number represents the percentage of people who acknowledge being aware of making these judgments. I think actually that number is probably closer to 100% in that we're all affected consciously or subconsciously by the interface that we're dealing with and make these judgments about the perceived credibility of the organization behind it based on the quality of that design.
It's not unlike a magazine in a newsstand, is it, where you can actually look at a quality of the stock, the glossiness of the paper, the photography in it, and get the impression about what the magazine or the organization's about, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very similar to that, and except here we don't have that tactile feel of the paper or the, you know, the look of, that sense of weight, if you can pick up a physical product, that sort of thing. So it's purely visual. And so that gives designers a lot of power, which we really like.
Yeah, it wasn't so long ago that companies built websites because everyone else was doing it. So when do you reckon the penny dropped for business and websites became a necessity and warranted this investment in time and resources?
Well, probably different times for different organizations, but you started to see the big players get involved really about 98, 99, when they really started jumping in and investing, and they've only ramped up that investment since as the return has been there. And obviously with the growth in e-commerce revenues, with the growing use of the Internet as a research vehicle, and increasingly where more and more media is being consumed, more and more organizations realize that they have to invest more and more to get that return, to maximize on the potential opportunity. represented by the online medium.
And obviously we have strategies when it comes to advertising. How important is an online strategy these days?
It's critical for any major initiative. You've got to have some good sense for what you're doing. And in fact, we devote part of the book to outlining what we think the major components of a website strategy should be, because so many of the site owners that we interact with have never actually documented that out. And I think there's an assumption in many cases that everyone knows what you're trying to accomplish, but quite often much of the internal conflict that we see when we work with clients has to do with differing assumptions about what the goal of the website should be. And when you're able to come in and help to clarify that for organizations, it makes everyone on the team that much more effective, that much more efficient, in that their jobs become clearer when you do have a well-defined strategy.
Yeah, and something we're seeing, a trend that's really exciting, is just this combination of online and offline advertising and marketing strategies, so that they're like one complete 360-degree advertising and marketing effort, and the website becomes just a piece of that, whereas there are TV ads, there are viral offline efforts going on, and all sorts of things that drive people to the website. And then when you're doing that, then you better be sure that your website is ready to receive that traffic and convert them.
It's a good point you make, actually. Advertising is, or could be considered as, an investment in business growth, and traditionally large budgets have been allocated to achieve this. As a percentage of total investment, what sort of funding should be given to an online presence, and what sort of return would you be expecting for your investment?
Well, it's hard to put a firm number on it. Again, I think it'll be different for every organization. But generally, the pattern that we see is that people spend far, far more than they do driving traffic to the website than they do on the website itself and thinking through that user experience. And what that usually means is that the website itself underperforms relative to its potential. And in our view, more and more organizations should be looking at investing more in the website, increasing the effectiveness of the website, increasing their conversion rate, their time on site, whatever their goal for the website is, such that they get the benefit of that increased conversion rate from that point on for all traffic that they drive moving forward. And the return on that type of an investment really is immense normally compared to the day in, day out, having to purchase traffic to the website. Better to invest once up front, make the whole thing more efficient, and then yield that benefit on an ongoing basis over time for all future traffic.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Compelling.
Every once in a while, a revolutionary product comes along that changes everything.
Judicious.
The question is really whether young people particularly are addicted to being connected to other people all the time.
Historical.
Today is a very important day in Australia's history. This is the day, the 6th of October, 2006, that life in Australia will be changed forever.
Caring.
I know as a parent, I would often say to my children, you've just spoken to this person for 8 hours at school. How can you sit online and chat to them for another 5 hours?
You heard of road rage? What about web rage?
They should be wearing a mask and carrying a gun.
Relations between Telstra and the federal government have been extremely strained almost from the moment Sol Trujillo became chief executive.
Optus had quite a good quarter, but its 3G service is very low profile at the moment.
And the Queen's got an iPod.
Betty's got one.
Yeah.
I wonder what she listens to. She'll probably listen to us.
An unexpectedly high number of voters swamped the system. Well, what did they expect?
Controversial.
Less attention is paid to the equally interesting question, should journalists blog?
Magical.
And I've got some residual powers.
Ambitious.
High-speed broadband, it's available in most of Asia as well as being in the rest of the world. Let's just make sure that we can get it in Australia this year, not next.
Religion.
Talking of the Roman Catholics, I have been on Vatican Radio.
Comedy.
You put the date on E-Pray, and you get a whole service. Just on.
How does it go?
It goes.
Insightful, entertaining, and informative. Tech Talk Radio. More than just technology.
It's a strictly rehearsed and finely polished program.
Have you heard something on Tech Talk Radio worth talking about? Are you looking to share your technical dilemmas or opinions with like-minded Tech Talk Radio listeners? Well, now you can. Introducing the Tech Talk Radio web forum. Visit forum.techtalkradio.com.au and join our community. It's free and on a web browser near you.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Let's talk a little bit about websites in general now, Lance. Is there such a thing as a perfect website? And if so, how do we go about building it if someone's never been there before?
Well, there's been some debate about that lately, and some people have put forth that there are commonalities between the best websites, but I doubt whether there is a perfect website necessarily. But how you get there really is by starting with a good strategy. Understanding what it is you want to accomplish, and as part of that, understanding what it is your users want to accomplish too, and then developing a strategy that combines or melds the goals of both. Because if you can develop strategies and develop a site that is highly usable and useful to your target audience, that also then meets your target objectives, well, that is that win-win scenario. That's going to allow everyone to be successful. It's harder to do than it sounds, but if you can do it, the potential upside is just amazing in many cases.
Yeah, and I'd say that also an important thing to remember is that once you reach a good website, to keep on trying to improve it and iteratively improve it and then test it, make improvements, test them, see if you've indeed made an improvement or if you've gone backwards, and then learn from each of your tests and implement what you've learned from those tests and going forward so that you're constantly growing and changing and improving to reflect the changing needs of your audience, the industry, and the online space.
Let's say, for example, I run a business and the website's not working correctly, or we've decided to start afresh with a brand new website. We're going to have a meeting in the boardroom. Who should I be inviting to that meeting from our organization?
I'd say you need your web designers. If you have a usability department, by all means, bring them on board. You need anybody who's working in IT so that they can implement tracking, make sure that's involved. Of course, you need your executive champions, so the people who are providing the funding or would be providing the funding for the project. Those are the key players I can think of offhand. And Lance, I'm sure you can add more.
Well, I would say anyone who has a stake in the website or whose department would be represented on the website, and then really, in our view, the primary decision makers need to be there. In many cases, that will be the CEO themselves, and we think that's just critical to be working with the ultimate decision maker from the get-go as much as possible so that the team doesn't spin their wheels iterating on designs that then, when finally presented to the CEO, for example, end up getting the thumbs down or end up getting watered down sometimes and resulting in mediocre designs that underperform relative to their potential. So get the big dog in the room if you can and get their buy-off as much as possible, via our sense.
Let's talk about the all-important homepage, the first page that traditionally most visitors come and see on your website. It has to be all-encompassing, and it has to be everything to everyone, to quote something from your book. What makes a good homepage, guys?
Well, a good homepage is one that's been looked at from the audience's perspective. So you look at who are the people that are coming to your website, and group them by audience, and then prioritize them according to how important is each audience to your business goals. If, for instance, you're a organization that relies on donations, then people who are likely to donate to you, that would be your primary audience. And those are the ones you want to prioritize in your design, provide the clearest path for action for, and make sure that you're providing the clearest messaging for. And then go through your list of the other audiences that are likely to come to your site. Make sure that they're all addressed and they all have available actions and clear paths, but you do want to prioritize the emphasis you place on their options according to the importance of the audience.
And getting into more specifics on the design side, one of the things that we really recommend is that you clearly identify your company and what you do for all audiences, because so many people are going to arrive there not necessarily having a clear indication of what you do, but potentially having different expectations of what they're going to find. And as part of that, one of the items we recommend quite often is developing what we call a functional tagline. That might be different than your normal marketing tagline or slogan, but a functional tagline really is the short, concise description that explains to someone what it is you do, so that in a very clear way, so that they are very, very clear on what you do. We have a number of examples in the book, but a lot of organizations get that wrong. The, you know, easy one would be, you know, get a piece of the rock, you know. That doesn't necessarily explain what you do, but if you were to instead replace that with insurance and wealth management services, that then explains for the new user exactly what you do. They don't have to think about it, and you get over that that initial dissonance that someone might otherwise have with more of a marketing tagline.
One of the things that did impress me, Lance, was the actual examples of other websites that you did put in the book. I think it's really good. It allows everyone to sort of get a bit of a feel for what you're talking about. As we know, pictures and words tell stories. How should we write for our website, and how much is too much on a page?
Well, again, there's no one answer for certain, but what we try to do is advise people to design their pages and write their pages to accommodate the different reading patterns that people have online. Some people are going to just scan very quickly and they won't read any block of copy. And so for those people, you have to provide these short taglines, perhaps bullet points, so that they can very quickly get a sense for what the content on the page is about and what the next step is. Other people are much more linear in their process and will read just about every word in the correct order that you place it on the page. And you want to be able to accommodate those people too and make sure that the page is giving them enough information. So it definitely is more art than science to get there. But the idea is to understand that there is no average user. You're actually designing for a lot of different types of people with different preferred reading patterns online.
It's funny you should mention that. There's normally a fight in the office from time to time amongst the designers versus the copywriters and who gets a bit more space and what has to be there. But I think that's the job for the agencies, really. That's what they do. Never before in the history of marketing have we been able to measure the success of an advertising campaign to the detail that we can today on our websites. How important is the structure of the website and the use of landing pages in the overall measurement of a campaign?
Well, it's just critical in our view, and that's why we start almost all of our chapters where we're talking about the different pages of the site with the metrics we recommend tracking for that page. Because you can do this now, a lot of organizations, let me start over. Because you have all of this data now, many organizations assume that that's all you need, and you just need to take a look at the data that your analytics system gives you. But in fact, you have to be much more focused than that, because it's so easy to be overwhelmed by the data that is thrown at you by these systems. And if you want to really get the most out of them, you want to figure out the metrics that matter most to you for each of these different pages that you're looking at on your site, and then optimizing the design of those pages to increase the throughput rate or the yield, whatever your objective is for each of those, so that collectively the site as a whole performs substantially better than it did previously. But to do so, you really need to focus in on exactly what the right metrics are for your organization.
Okay, let's talk about collecting information, because in a lot of respects, that's probably one of the main roles of a website these days. You're fighting a bit of an uphill battle when it comes to privacy issues, and people are just getting a little bit suspect these days about putting their personal details into a web form. How do we go about firstly encouraging visitors to fill in the forms, and secondly, getting the quality information that an organization would want?
Well, that's where we come to form design, and also making sure that we provide reassurances about the privacy and security provisions that are in place on a website. You know, it's been shown that in many cases on a reputable website, and of course that goes back to establishing your credibility so people do trust you and using design to establish that credibility. But once you're on a credible website, your credit card information and your other personal information is very often much more secure than if you hand your credit card over to a server at a restaurant or, you know, some other public store situation. So it's making sure that your forms are easily visible on a page so the visitor's eye is drawn to that form. They see what they need to do, and making it clear what they're supposed to do once they filled out the form. So making sure your button that they're supposed to click once they're completed with the form is available and very visual. And also, as far as the number of fields that you put on your form, make sure that you're not asking for information that you don't actually need. A lot of people, when they put a form up, they'll say, well, it's just one more field. Let's go ahead and ask for their fax number or their mobile phone number or some other type of information that's not really crucial to their marketing effort. So what we advise is don't strip down your form fields to just two, but make sure that every single field that you do include in your form is crucial to your effort. And it really has been looked at carefully to make sure that it's crucial. And then the last thing about form design is, again, providing that reassurance that you treat people's information and their privacy very seriously. So providing a visual reassurance by using a lock icon, a little text reassurance saying, we value your privacy, or something along that lines. Here's our privacy policy. You can read it right here. We are serious about this. And then also, a basic thing is make sure that page is actually secure with a secure server or secure certificate.
It sort of goes in full circle to what you were saying before, Sandra, that the quality of the information that you're going to get from a visitor is really proportional to the quality of your design of your site. If you've got a really lovely looking site which just oozes credibility and reputation, that people are going to be wanting to give you that information more so than hesitant about it.
I agree, and there's an interesting piece of information from research done by Donald Norman, who is a cognitive psychologist and one of the people we really appreciate. And he's put out that things that look nice actually do function better. And that's because people, when they see something that they like, they actually are willing to give it a little more leeway as far as how well it works. And they enjoy using it so much that they're willing to just kind of have a little more patience with it, work with it, spend more time with it, and so forth. So as that translates to the web, if your website looks credible, looks professional, looks, you know, beautiful within your industry, then they already have an impression of you that is very favorable, and you've gained a great deal in their goodwill. And then you have that to draw from, as if they do encounter problems on your site, they're more willing to forgive it and think of you still as a credible organization.
There's plenty of tools to measure traffic on sites these days. Are some better than others, and how do we really measure the success of a website?
Well, there certainly are a lot of tools out there. There's no question about that, and the industry seems to be consolidating somewhat, but at the same time, there are a lot of new entrants, too. Whether there are some better than others, again, you know, it's going to depend on your needs, your budget, and really an analysis of the functionality that's going to give you the metrics that you need to be able to measure success. In terms of free tools, the fact that there are free tools at all, I think, is really just a major boon, especially for the small mom-and-pop businesses out there, because they're quite good. In the case of Google Analytics, for example, I think, inarguably, the best free tool out there, very powerful, got even a fair amount of customization capabilities so that you can gather some great metrics on your site, and we're even seeing larger organizations starting to use that. Higher-end tools out there, I've heard analysts say good things about Omniture. I've heard them say good things about Web Trends. Certainly some of the others as well, but you know, again, it comes down to case by case as to which is going to work best for each organization.
Personally, I've noticed that a lot of customers of mine really, once they understand how they interpret analytics, for example, in web pages, they can see where traffic's come from and where they're going through their site. It actually generates a buzz of enthusiasm towards the website within that organization. Have you found that to be the case?
Yeah, definitely. I think once people start seeing a visual representation or a numerical representation of how many people come to their site, where they go, where they have problems, it just makes it real for them, because otherwise they have no way to think about where people are having problems and what they're doing on a website. So, for instance, if you line up a checkout procedure and you look at the analytics for each of the pages in that stepwise process, and all of a sudden you can see that at one certain point in that checkout process, a whole bunch of the visitors no longer continued to the end of the process. Suddenly that becomes real. Instead of just thinking, oh, we have a poorly performing checkout process, and having it be a very general sort of ephemeral thought process, it becomes very concrete and very real. And yes, it does generate a lot of enthusiasm. It's great to see.
And the web metrics really are what provides the bridge between the design audience and the site management team and the business team. And that's really one of the other reasons that we wrote the book, was to try to bring these disparate schools of thought together to collaborate more and more on the design of the site, gaining an appreciation for the business impacts that the site can have. And it really is the metrics that bring that all together and provide the rallying point for everyone.
Sandra, you mentioned checkouts and the ability to monitor people through the checkout. Tell me about shopping carts. They've generally been perceived as a bit of a, oh, here we go, it's a process, I don't like this. Is that still the general feeling for people in shopping carts? Because I personally think, oh, here we go, a shopping cart, and it's like, yeah, it's not a very friendly experience. What's happening in that sort of realm?
You know, there are a lot of developments that are being made in that area, because you're right, most people see that and they come to a shopping cart, they've had trouble with them in the past, they're poorly designed for a large part, because they come from a... Yeah, they were one of the earliest developments on the web. You know, people wanted to sell people other things very early on.
Yeah, and they're traditionally a plug-in, aren't they? It's something you bolt on after the thought, so it doesn't follow the style of your site. It doesn't just it's just the sore thumb of your site, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. It looks like an appendage that doesn't belong there, and people get confused when they come to it. Again, it's poorly designed based on old types of needs on the web, and so. What we're seeing now, though, is some newer companies that are providing even third-party shopping carts are providing advanced options like single-page checkout, meaning that instead of having to go from page to page, entering information on every page, and it's, you know, like a 5 or 6-step process, it's one page, very intuitively laid out, very simple to get through. And that type of checkout system is extremely effective and is a huge improvement. So we're seeing more and more companies moving to that sort of situation, that sort of solution, rather.
One thing we haven't really spoken of, and I don't think you really talk too much detail about in the book too, is e-newsletters, which are in effect are mini websites that get emailed out to customers in the form of just an email. Almost an extension of the website, really, that we send to our customers. Do the same principles apply here?
Well, yeah, I would say that anything that you send out to your customers, first of all, it needs to include your branding, and it needs to be... If it includes a link back to the website, which many, and in fact most newsletters do, then that branding, that look, that credibility needs to be maintained so that the visitor experience is consistent from your newsletter, from any sort of email or online advertisement that you put out there. And that way when they come to your website, they're already prepared to see. They've already have an expectation and a positive one of what they're going to see.
Yeah, I'm so impressed with the emails that I get from Apple, for example. They really do it right. Branded properly, minimalist design, you know, consistent with their whole ethos. But also, more importantly, when I click through from the email to whatever landing page they've designated, there is that sense of consistency, both in terms of design and copy, such that it is a smooth transition. I would imagine that bears itself out in them having relatively low bounce rates relative to other people running email campaigns who don't achieve that same synchronicity between the email and the landing page experience.
To conclude, guys, where to from here? How are sites going to evolve, and are we going to see more rich media come into websites? In fact, let's look, say, 4 years down the track. What are the websites of 2012 going to look like, and how will we be interacting with them?
Well, I think we'll be interacting with them in largely the same way, but they'll operate much more smoothly than they will now, and we'll see much heavier usage of Ajax and Flash type technologies, where there won't be as much page reloading. More transactions will occur, if you will, via this so-called pageless design, where you will have pages expanding and collapsing in response to different actions you take, and as you fill in information, for example. And so the speed at which the whole experience operates, I think, will be increased dramatically. And hopefully, this will be done in a way that it's still very intuitive and easy for users to use. And overall, this will contribute to the, you know, the growth in e-commerce and in the growth rates of people using the internet to research products and get useful things done in their lives.
I think another major trend coming on board as well is the expansion of the mobile web. As wireless networks expand, as the technology expands as far as devices to interact with the internet, that will be a larger portion of website development, is making sure that your website is also accessible from a mobile device and available that way as well.
All interesting points, and I think it's very much going to be an interesting landscape as it evolves in the next few years. Lance Loveday and Sandra Niehaus, thank you very much. Your book, Web Design for Return on Investment, is available, I think you were saying, on Amazon. Is that right? If listeners want to try and pick up a copy, because I think it's good for the business, the CEO, the marketing guy, the web designer, anyone who has any interest in web design whatsoever, you can start off with some good habits, I think.
Yeah. Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much, Andrew.
You're listening.
Dr. Ron?
Here I am.
Residual powers.
And I've got some residual powers.
You can't turn off CDMA.
In terms of the volume,
over a centimeter. Fingerprints.
Now, this...
We may have digressed.
Talk radio.
Phil Burgess also claimed the country would remain behind.
We used to think 600
kilometers. Don't open the thing, but it's good that you're not expecting, even if they do a thing like it.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Subscribing to the Tech Talk Radio podcast is so easy. It's child's play.
Podcasting's so easy, even my little brother can do it.
Step one, visit the iTunes Music Store and search for Tech Talk Radio in the podcast section. Step two, click subscribe and you're done. Now every week you'll be able to listen to Tech Talk Radio whenever, wherever and however you like. You could be mowing the lawn, on a train, in a car, on a plane, at work,
Podcast
visiting the relatives,
Todd
washing the
Charlie
car.
Christine.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Windows Server 2008 is the next generation of server operating system from Microsoft. It is successor to Windows 2003 and was originally known as Windows Server Longhorn until May the 16th in 2007, when Bill Gates announced its official title. Windows Server 2008 is a server operating system containing many of the new client features from Windows Vista, not unlike the relationship between Windows Server 2003 and Windows XP. Beta 1 was released in July of 2005, Beta 2 was announced and released in May 2006, and the final beta, Beta 3, was released publicly in April this year. Today on Tech Talk Radio, we talk to Julia Sinkevicius, the Senior Product Manager of Microsoft Windows Server Division based in the United States. Julius joined the Windows Server Division in 2005 as a Senior Product Manager for Windows Server 2003 and Microsoft Windows Server 2008 product. Julia started working in information technology in 1991 and has held various positions in systems and network administration. In 1998, he joined Microsoft as part of the Microsoft Consulting Services Group and worked with some of Canada's largest companies deploying infrastructure servers. In 2000, he moved to Redmond, Washington and worked in the Microsoft Learning and Tablet PC groups.
I was keen to find out about the evolution of Server 2003 to 2008 and how it would make a difference to small business, its target market. Windows Server 2008 is built from the same code base as Windows Vista, therefore it shares much of its same architecture and functionality. So Julius, can you tell us a little bit about what's new in Server 2008?
Well, Windows Server 2008 is a major release for us compared to Windows Server 2003 R2. And as you mentioned, it's based on the same development project that Vista was. That was the codename Longhorn. So it does share a lot of the same features that Vista has from an architecture and technology point of view. But obviously, because it's a server release, there's a lot of new features that are specifically designed for enterprises and businesses and their networks. So first off, we improve what we call the fundamentals of the operating system. So this is improvements in manageability and reliability of the operating system, allowing people to spend less time on everyday tasks and spending more time on solving complex issues or adding value back to the business. Also making the operating system much more reliable. So reducing the amount of patching and reboots that's required for the operating system. So that's just at the fundamental level. And we also made improvements in adding protection or increased security for the operating system. So we have network access protection. We have protection for data stored on the hard drive with a technology called BitLocker. And also we've made some other enhancements in our directory services. Also, we have a new web server in Windows Server 2008, IS7, which is a big enhancement. And we'll be introducing virtualization as part of the operating system with Windows Server 2008. So a lot of changes compared to 2003.
All right, let's put it into perspective for a small business these days. Take, for example, maybe a small to medium-sized business, 5 clients, maybe a roving laptop or two. They want internet access and a print server. What benefits will 2008 bring to them?
Well, there's from different perspectives. So from a management perspective, we've made the management of the server a lot easier. So if you were familiar with 2003, just to get the server up and running and configuring it, you had to go through between 6 and 8 different steps and use different tools just to get the operating system up and running. Now it's very simple, very streamlined. There's one tool called Server Manager, which will allow you to easily bring up the server and configure it. So for a small, medium business, just bringing the operating system up is very simple.
Just talking about compatibility or backward compatibility with clients such as XP and 2000 and even, heaven forbid, 98, how do these operating systems talk to Server 2008?
So from a client perspective or from your desktop connecting to the server, it would work just like any other server, so very similar to 2003. So we don't distinguish between different clients. We still use the same protocols. However, if you're using Windows Vista on the as your client, we made several protocol changes on the networking side and on the file access side, specifically with what we call the SMB, the protocol for accessing files off the server. And this, the new protocol changes will make significant performance changes for end users using Vista talking to a Windows Server 2008 server. And if you have a distributed environment where you might have a branch office or you have mobile users, you'll see that the performance is greatly improved in those kind of disconnected scenarios.
Well, that sounds very exciting, actually. Vista 2000, I bought my first laptop the other day, and you're always a bit apprehensive about moving into the new technology, but so far so good. The one thing that I have noticed is the security, which is out of the box on Vista, is it prompts a lot of questions. Do you really want to do this? Do you really want to run that? Is that the case for the Server 2008 as well? Is that the level of security out of the box?
The server security is different for different parts of the operating system. So by default, Windows Server only installs what you need to be installed. So when you install the operating system, basically until you configure it or tell it to install features like IIS or network access protection, it'll only install those features. So by default, it's a secure system. It's locked down. We reduce the surface attack area. But where we've made improvements on for your entire environment is with network access protection. So this is a new feature in Windows Server 2008 where we will allow you to provide additional security for your environment. So as clients such as Vista or previous versions of Windows like XP, when they join the network or try to connect to the network, before they get access to any resources, we'll do a scan of the system health of that client and determine whether that client has the right levels of, you know, antivirus software, anti-spyware, latest security patches, and so on. And then once we've determined that that client is has a valid health policy, then we'll allow them to join the network. So we're providing security at many different levels within the operating system. So is it secure out of the box? Absolutely. Security is a little bit different because it is on the server side, and but it provides security not just for the operating system, but also for data and for people accessing the network.
So is this what you're calling the new network access protection, one of the features in 2008?
Yes. So it's enabled in 2008, and Windows Vista has the client software already built into it because it does require some client components. But network access protection is one of our key features in Windows Server 2008. And really, we see this being used by all types of different customers because it does provide, you know, additional value or protection for your network. So what was happening before, and how this feature kind of came about, is, you know, a client or a user would be able to, traveling with their laptop, they would maybe pick up a virus, they'd go back to their network, at their business and kind of pollute the network with that virus. Then the administrator would scan the network, secure everything. Then again, someone else would go out, pick up a virus, and bring it back to the company. So what we're trying to do is to make sure that before anyone can connect to the network, that they have it's a clean machine. And if it isn't clean, it has a virus or something, or doesn't meet the security policy, then we have a way of rectifying that, either by upgrading that client to the right level of security or restricting that client from having access to the network whatsoever.
So let's have a look at IIS 7, which is the built-in web server, which comes with, well, with IIS 6 was in R2 of 2003, and we're moving on to IIS 7. Are there anything new and exciting that's going to get everyone going for the new version of IIS?
Yeah, there's a lot of new things. So IIS 6, which a lot of people don't realize, but, you know, we released that in April 2003, and, over the 4 years we've had it out on the market, we've had zero critical security vulnerabilities. So it's been a great product for us. With IIS 7, we take that even further. So it's more componentized. So IIS 6 had 7 different configuration options. We're up to over 40 with IIS 7. So that means you only install what you need, because you only install the components that you want. You only need to patch what you need. So it becomes easier to manage. We also have the ability to delegate administration. So if you have a web server environment, you don't have to give full administrative rights to the application developer or to the administrator. You can delegate who's going to administer which part of the web server. We also have support for things like PHP, which is very exciting for a lot of developers. IIS 7, we also announced a couple weeks ago, will now be supported as a role on Server Core. And Server Core, if you're not familiar with, is the installation option for Windows Server to have a smaller footprint server with fewer services running on it. And IIS 7 will now run as a Server Core role.
Okay, and terminal services, what are the major changes to that?
So there's two new enhancements. One's called the remote app, and the other one is the terminal services gateway. So what remote app allows you to do is to publish an application through terminal services, and so when the end user launches that application, they don't get the remote desktop. What they'll get is just that application. So, for example, Visio is a common example that we use at Microsoft, because I don't necessarily use Visio all the time. But if someone sends me a Visio document, I want to be able to open up that document. So I can hit a terminal server, and Visio will come up on my desktop. Even though it's running off that server, it looks like and acts like it's running on my desktop. It supports drag and drop, interact with the system tray, and so on. So that's a great solution for applications. Common scenario is a company wants to roll out a brand new application overnight to all their users. Instead of physically installing the application on every single desktop, they can just roll out a remote app, and then everyone can get access to that application running on Terminal Server. So that's one enhancement. The other enhancement is through the Terminal Services Gateway. And I kind of touched upon this earlier. And what we're allowing you to do is to allow your users to have a Terminal Services session just using HTTPS or SSL to get access to it. So you don't need a VPN anymore. So I could be, as long as I have an internet connection, whether it's at home or my hotel room, at a coffee shop or a cafe or somewhere, I have my laptop, I'm able to establish an internet connection. I can use go back, tunnel through to my corporate terminal server and then run an application or run a email session or so on. So this is a great solution for people who travel a lot and don't need to go back to their office and don't want to set up a VPN connection.
And Microsoft is boasting these new technologies, which you've mentioned earlier on, like ServiceCore and PowerShell. Can you briefly tell us a little bit about what they are and how they work in 2008?
Sure. So first I'll talk about ServiceCore. So ServiceCore is an installation option. So when you install, whether it's standard or enterprise or data center edition or web server, you have an option to install ServiceCore. And what ServiceCore will do is it will install the base operating system files that you need, such as the kernel, networking services, and so on. And then it will install the role that you want. So if you want to be a file server or a DNS server and so on. And that's it. And so it's basically the core operating system. But what it doesn't have like Windows Explorer or Internet Explorer or media players. In fact, there's no graphical user interface whatsoever. So when you boot it up, it comes up like a very similar to what DOS used to look like.
That's a command line system, is it? Yeah.
A command line.
Yep.
And everything is managed by command line. Or you can manage it remotely by using command line or MMC. Microsoft Management Console tools to manage that remote server. So because it is a minimal installation of the operating system, it does require less patching. In our estimation, is that if we had done this for Windows Server 2003, you would have been able to eliminate about 60% of the patches for those specific roles that run on the ServiceCore. Now, ServiceCore doesn't support all the roles. So, for example, SharePoint services. SharePoint requires the .NET framework to be present, and so there is no .NET framework on ServiceCore, so you can't run SharePoint. But you can run, file, print, DNS, DCP. I mentioned IIS, also Windows Media Services, and some other key roles. So that's the server installation. Now, PowerShell, on the other hand, is a new scripting and environment and language that allows you to create and execute fairly complex scripts so you can start automating different parts of managing your servers. So it's based on the .NET framework, so it is very powerful. It leverages your existing scripts and batch files you have, but also has a new set of commands that you can do things like, create user accounts and make settings on the server and so on. So it becomes a very easy way to automate a lot of things that people used to do manually. And that's kind of our goal with Windows Server 2008, is to really allow you to spend less time on managing everyday things and reducing the complexity of the server. So as a business, you can focus more on things that add value back to the business.
All right, and finally, Julius, I'd like to talk about migration from 2003 to 2008. What's the recommended path if an IT or company wants to move into the new realms of 2008? Is it how would you recommend them go about it?
So it depends on the roles of main function of the server that you want to migrate. So, for example, if it's just the target server you want to migrate is what we call like a core infrastructure server. So if it's a DNS server or DHCP server or Active Directory server, those are pretty straightforward. and allows us, and we can do, and we can do like an in-place migration for those. Now, for other types of servers where you're running applications, those are more complex. So, for example, if you're having a, if you have an application, it's a billing system and so on, you know, we wouldn't recommend necessarily to do a in-place migration to Windows Server 2008. It just requires a lot more investigation and testing. So one of the items we're encouraging right now with our customers is that, we've reached a beta 3 milestone a few months ago, and customers should be going out and getting beta 3 and start trialing it in their environment to see how beta 3 will work in their environment and what kind of changes that they need to make in order to move to 2008.
Windows Server 2008 is scheduled for official release on February 27 next year. You can hear the full half-hour conversation I had with Julius, which goes into a little bit more technical detail, on our website at techtalkradio.com.au.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Optus decided to start metering their uploads, like Telstra does, like Dodo does.
Podcasting is child's play.
Yes, it caused a whole heap of very interesting discussion. Have you ever bought music online?
Yeah, I have, and I've been bitterly disappointed.
Really?
Yeah. 128 kilobits per second.
Which is disgraceful.
And it sounds like absolute crap.
Well, I suppose it depends whether you like that sort of underwater metallic-y sound you get from the MP3s that you download.
There was a program on the ABC about people like you.
Oh, really?
There's already an open standard. Why did the other one have to come into existence?
The high priest of open source software have congregated at Google's headquarters.
Almost surprised there's not software written for Media Center that would do the same thing.
I need help here, boys. The poor old iPhone didn't quite survive. It had a bit of a crack.
It's a strictly rehearsed and finely polished program.
It is.
Entertaining, informative and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Here's another great moment in technology
on Tech Talk Radio.
Ohm's Law, named after its discoverer, Georg Ohm, states that the potential difference between two points along a connected path and the current flowing through it are proportional at a fixed temperature. Prior to Ohm's work, a qualitative relationship between voltage and current was worked out by Henry Cavendish. Cavendish experimented with Leyden jars. And Leyden jars were the first capacitor invented in 1745 and used to conduct many early experiments in electricity. He used glass tubes of varying diameter and length filled with salt solution. He measured the current by noting how strong a shock he felt as he completed the circuit with his body. Cavendish wrote that the current varied directly as the voltage, and these results were unknown until published in 1879. Ohm did his work in resistance in the year 1825 and 1826 and published his results in 1827. This has been another great moment in technology on Tech Talk Radio.
The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
What I'd like to talk about is Mark's and my weekend away. We had a lovely weekend away.
Where did you go?
We went to a place called Mount Gambier. Heard of it?
Yeah, I've heard of Mount Gambier. It's on the border between Victoria and New South Wales.
It is.
Very nice town. Lots of deep holes, though. You got to watch out for the holes.
Very volcanic.
Victoria, South Australia, actually.
It's what?
On the border of Victoria
it
and
is.
South Australia.
Yes.
New South Wales.
Oh, it's
west, not north, from where we are.
Sorry, did I say New South Wales? I'm sorry. I apologise.
Right. West. Yeah, it's good. But anyway, nonetheless, what it's all about is a really good, fun weekend where you really get to learn how to use technology for the sake of using technology and no other reason. It's a recreational pastime. So for those who have a need to be in the bush, four-wheel driving, or not even four-wheel driving, in a regular sedan, there are a few of those out there with us as well. It wasn't that impossible. What we ended up doing was... I don't know, how long has it been going for, Mark? It's been a tradition for many years.
I've been going for 20 years, and it's been going a lot longer than that.
So. 20 years. Mm. Yeah. Well, there's a mob over there called the Southeast Radio Group, and they provide this function, which is a bit of a good boys' weekend away. So you get to take the car, leave the girls behind. There are a few girls there competing on the weekend, those that wanted to, but if you feel the urge to get out and run through the bush, a bit like orienteering...
But we haven't got to the nub of what you were doing. You were hunting down radio transmitters, is that right?
Yeah, pretty much. It's a bit like a glorified hide and seek, except instead of using, like the kids do, they hide something around the house and then they all go off and look for it. This is...
So you go out somewhere outside of Mount Gambier, hide a radio transmitter.
Yes, several radio transmitters. Not just one, many.
Okay.
Many. And then you have to go find them all.
And then everybody hoons off and tries to track them down.
Yeah. And then, and instead of, as you would sort of think, oh, that sounds pretty boring, let me tell you about the forest in Mount Gambier. And travelling through that, because there's pine plantations, yep. There's beautiful pasture land over there. It's a really very pretty space. There's the beach just down the road a little bit. There's Millicent, all that sort of lovely coastal area. Yeah, there's some two volcanoes there.
Mm-hmm. And you work in teams, Andrew. So
that's right.
You compete against each other. There's a lot of competition between the teams.
That's right.
And when you actually find one of the radio transmitters, do you just hang around and wait for the other teams, or what do you do?
Some you do, yes. If it's just, you just have to find one transmitter, yeah, you find it and you go, well, that was hard, and everyone compares notes and things like that. But when you are hunting successive transmitters, so you find one, then you go and find the next one and the one after that and the one after that, it becomes quite an adrenaline rush, especially when you've got other people chasing one and you don't know what's going on. And of course, just picture this, the middle of the night, pitch black, sub-zero temperatures. It's pretty cold in Mount Gambier at the best times. It normally always rains too, and it didn't let us down there either. Fog comes down to ground level beautifully, and you can't see your hand in front of your face. It's just one of those really things. And you're in the car, and you're working together as a team. The driver's sort of looking out for all the obstacles on the road and travelling through the forest at sort of, you know, reasonable speed. And the beam swinger is sort of saying, oh, it's coming from this way.
The what?
The beam swinger.
What's that?
Good question, actually. That was Mark's role in this incident. He was doing that.
We
what happens?
We had a stretch team, didn't we? Three
we
of
did.
Us from all different teams got together, and it was a great weekend because of it. So, A beam swinger is the person who turns the antenna that's attached to the car to find the direction of the signal and adjusts the radio and the attenuation so they can get it just at the right level to tell which way it's coming from.
Really, he gives us the direction.
It's so the beam is the antenna.
The beam is the antenna. Yeah, another name for an antenna, like a Yagi, is called a beam.
And you're operating radio equipment to try and find the direction.
Yep, that's right. So we tune it in and adjust the attenuation so you can just hear it. So the only time you can hear it is when it's coming from that direction, the direction
when
that
you've got to point it straight at it.
Yeah, when you're pointing straight
and
at it.
And you tell the driver and the driver drives in that direction?
No, I tell the navigator, which was Andrew's driver.
Yeah, I was navigating.
Navigating.
You should have seen us. We had laptops everywhere. It was really good. And GPS things plugged into moving map technology, all off-the-shelf sort of stuff. In fact, there's a page on the Tech Talk Radio website. If you want to go and have a look, I can't remember the exact URL, but under transcripts on the right-hand side, you'll be able to see some pictures about what we're going to play for you in just a sec. And you can have a look at all the fun
and games.
Only
one time on the weekend did I tell the driver directly which way to go and found that I got us in trouble and we had to actually drive back out again on another road. So gave up on that idea. Always tell the navigator where the direction of the signal's coming from.
Because you might have the signal coming from a certain direction, but the navigator's the person who's looking at a map and he says, well, to get to that direction...
We turn right when I said turn right. But it was like a dead end. So we basically had to turn left and then go down a street and then turn left again and come back out.
So you really do need to work as a team.
Yeah, very much so.
It is a good team sport. There you go. I've just found on the website. If you go to technology, then click transcripts, then click radio sport in Australia.
From our website.
From our website, the Tech Talk Radio website, you'll find out all about it. It's a really good, fun sort of hobby.
I mean, where else would you want to be on a Saturday night, you know, about 0 degrees temperature, you know, late at night, and you're doing, you know, what, 40 to 60 kilometres an hour through a dirt pine forest, you know, with a whole lot of other teams that are sort of, you know, bright lights coming at you from all
and
directions.
The other teams were from South Australia, Victoria, and New South Wales. They came from far afield. It's a bit cold for the Queenslanders. They don't make it down there, but although they have had Queensland teams in the past, from recollection. So
a long way for them to travel.
It is a bit of a drive for the weekend, yes.
How many teams are we talking?
Well, we had 11 participating teams of about, you know, four people per team while we were there. So that was quite a good turnout when you think of it that way.
Years gone by, we've had up to 20 teams. I think the record I saw was 22 teams competed on one hunt one year. So
that's
22
amazing.
Cars with people in them, got gear.
Does everybody take it in turns to hide the transmitter, or who sets up the course for you?
No, the Southeast Radio Group run the convention and they have all their members take turns to put the transmitter out, usually running it from the car, but at some events required to be on foot as well, so they'll hide it actually in the bush with a person, you know, running a battery-packed radio.
So you get as far as you can in the car and then someone hops out of the car on foot with equipment to find it?
Yeah, a bit similar to what Adam Scammell's come in and done in that orienteering overseas sort of thing, so similar equipment to that.
Yeah, we've got to mention that it is an international sport. There's a lot of interest in it overseas, not just here in Australia. So it's good fun. And if anyone wants to get into it, there's some great opportunities here in Melbourne. There's a monthly hunt that they do from time to time, and I guess there are in some of the other centres as well.
The on-foot stuff that we talked about with Adam, but very big in Europe, but the in-car stuff is a lot bigger in the States.
It sounds very similar to a hobby that a lot of listeners might know about called geocaching.
Oh, we ran into the geocachers, didn't we?
That's
we
right.
were sharing a crater with the geocachers.
Well, yeah.
And people are going up, did you find it? And they go, yeah. And they were actually geocachers and they didn't realise.
Oh, so you didn't. We've got multiple competitions
there
running.
There was 120 something, but I don't remember there was 120 geocaching people looking or there was 120 geocachers hidden.
If you Google geocache, if you don't know what that's all about, I think it's a very
similar
thing.
You've spoken about this in previous lives, haven't you, Mark?
Yeah, I've tried it out before. So, yeah. You know, there's a geocaching website.
It's
and
a great
it
way to
you,
practice with your GPS receiver and so on.
That's right.
Yeah. It's a great abuse of technology, really, isn't it?
This is another level on top of geocaching. This is actually using radio transmitters, and you don't know. You've got a map, but you don't know where the thing is. Whereas with geocaching, you know where you're headed.
Yeah, and you get cryptic clues to find it.
It's a bit like Spotto, really, isn't it? All right, here's our report from the weekend. And once again, if you want to have a look on the radio, just go to the Tech Talk Radio site. What did I say? If you want to have a look on the website while we're listening on the radio, techtalkradio.com.au, transcripts, radio sport in Australia. So you've got some spare time on your hands and you're looking for a challenge to keep yourself occupied in the coming years. You love getting into the bush and you like exploring new places. Maybe you have a four-wheel drive and an interest in GPS navigation and radio communications. On the other hand, you may have an interest in orienteering, the sport of finding your way through all sorts of terrain with only a map and a compass, and these days a GPS. Or perhaps you just like socialising with like-minded people who love technology and the great outdoors. If you take everything I've just mentioned and combine them into one sport, you have an event called Radio Sport, or as the regulars like to call it, fox hunting. Now before you get on your high horse and start ranting and raving about cruel and barbaric sports, there's no furry little critters to be seen anywhere. The fox is a radio transmitter which is hidden somewhere in the bush, anywhere in fact, and the hounds are the teams of runners who go in search of these transmitters. The radio signals from the transmitters concerned can travel many kilometres, and hence the use of a vehicle to get you close certainly saves on the legwork. Teams consist of anywhere from two or more members in one single vehicle, or just a single runner or hound if a vehicle isn't necessary. Armed with a radio receiver, a directional radio antenna, a GPS mapping device, and the spirit of adventure with a dash of adrenaline, teams, otherwise known as the hounds, compete to see who can find the fox or hidden transmitter first. Who in their right mind would be involved in such a sport, you might ask? Well, would you believe radio sport is an international competition? Suffice to say that I'm currently standing at the bottom of a volcanic crater in the middle of Mount Gambier in South Australia for the first event of the 2007 Australian Championships. It's a brisk June afternoon, about 10 degrees or so, as about 30 or 40 people prepare to walk or run around the Blue Lake crater in search of 11 hidden radio transmitters. They're holding what they call sniffers, directional radio receivers, which make a high-pitched noise when you're heading in the right direction. Wayne Kilpatrick is the convention coordinator of the Southeast Radio Group's 2007 convention.
They have to find, hopefully they have to find 11 11 transmitters with their sniffers, and they're set throughout the crater lakes in the Blue Lake. Some are up high, some are down low. Some are near water, some are all over the place. And we've allowed them 2 hours, and then they have to complete the event. And if anything is per normal for this particular event, they'll be absolutely exhausted by the time they get back.
Has there been any form of trickery involved in this, or is it just relatively straightforward so anyone could do it?
No, everybody knows that when we set the course, it's always legit. There's never two transmitters on the same frequency. To confuse the issue, that would just be totally unfair. But no, there is a bit of skullduggery goes on, because knowing amateurs, the shortest distance between two points is a straight line. And if you have, without giving too much away, but if you have two transmitters, one's up high and one's down low, and they think of a straight line, some of the straight lines are very steep.
What size area is the playing field here today?
Yeah, we've got 11 transmitters going in an area of about 5 square kilometres, right throughout the Valley Lake, as part of the Blue Lake, which is part of the Blue Lake complex. So if they look at the Blue Lake complex, not the Big Lake, but the other area to the side of it, they'll see what that is. And yeah, it's just it's a fantastic venue. There's barbecues, wildlife parks. Who knows? I don't think any of the guys tied anything on an emu or something. So, but I suspect that there'll be a hit a transmitter in there somewhere.
After a brief run-through with the competitors on what to expect, Wayne unceremoniously started the event, sending the waiting masses off into the volcanic bush with the quest of finding 11 transmitters within the allotted 2 hours.
So when the boys have got their 2 hours to do this, the 11 transmitters, any points they get from this event, they will absolutely earn.
What do you expect the attrition rate to be on this one?
Oh, I would say about 50%. I don't think... I don't want to put them down, but I suspect that if they can find, of the 11, if they can find 6 of them, 50% of them find 6 of them, I'll be pretty pleased with that.
Adam Scammell was the first to complete the course, finding all 11 transmitters. Spirits were high with a good sense of humour as the first event concluded.
What was it like out there?
I had a good time, yeah. It was quite challenging. It was I had a GPS I was running with just to get an idea of how far I travelled, but unfortunately it was off for about, 30% of the time, so I really don't know. But, I come across a cliff fairly early, which was a bit daunting. I decided to turn around and attack that one later from a different angle.
So how did you go on the flats? Did you spend a lot of time at one altitude, or were you going up and down the hills all the time?
I tried to get what I could without, climbing, etc. So I made sure that the outer ones that were up the top, I got them towards the end, and once I was up there, I stayed up there. So it made for a long run all the way around the outside, but I think it helped.
Now, you're fairly fit and, well-dressed for the occasion. Do you think anyone who's not quite that way built would enjoy it just as much as you did?
Yeah, I got mentioned to me at the start that it was going to be a runner's course. It was a mountain goat type thing, so I figured it would sort of benefit us, whereas maybe some of the teams with older competitors or, the heavier competitors might struggle a bit.
The Saturday night hunt is what makes the teams trek to Mount Gambier. This year, there are entrants from South Australia, Victoria and New South Wales. The evening hunt starts at 8 p.m. and sees teams cover anywhere from 150 to 400 kilometres, depending on how good their equipment and navigation is. The town of Mount Gambier itself is a bustling country town, which is home to several thousand hectares of pine plantations. It's also not far from the coast and has lush green farmland and some amazing volcanic attractions. This in itself makes it ideal countryside for such an event. The night hunt has 5 transmitters to find in a specific order. As the teams arrive for the start, the air of excitement starts to get the adrenaline pumping. Brian Ackerley from Melbourne is a member of the defending champions team.
Brian, how confident are you feeling tonight?
reasonably.
There's a hell of a lot of technology here in front of you. What does it all do?
Well... No, I think it's where do I start? We've got a little GPS mapping thing here, which is not really terribly useful. They've got automatic attenuation, which just as we get closer to the transmitter, it just automatically cuts the signal back and tells you how much by, so you don't need to worry about flicking switches. The rest of it's pretty standard, just a meter to show your signal strength.
The night hunt, would that be one of your favourite hunts when you come over to Mount Gambier?
Absolutely, yeah. It's like the pinnacle event almost. It's the one that sort of, it almost makes and breaks the whole thing. If you do well in the night hunt, you usually can, you're going to do fairly well for the whole event.
How long do you reckon we'll be out here for tonight? We've got, 272, 6 and 10. There's 5 legs.
Yeah, that's right. Probably, not that many years ago, we used to wonder whether we'd find them all in the time that was allotted to us. Now we expect to be able to do that, but the issue is going to be just in how long. I think in a couple of hours to do all 5 legs probably is about, I think we'd do it in about that time. I think the best teams should normally do it in about that time.
Steve Howe.
How prepared are you for the night hunt this evening?
Oh, it's all working at the moment.
How confident are you for the evening?
Looks like it's going to work. It worked this afternoon, so hopefully we don't get any blips. It worked quite well, actually. So considering that it's a brand new laptop and nothing was really prepared much in the forefront, but it's come out really well.
And what technology are you running here? Just really the mapping software, anything else?
We're running a homegrown control program for the mapping, which controls the PCR 1000, plotting of lines, the snail trail, routing in and interpreting GPS.
But you've got to admit, with all this technology, there's still a hell of a lot of luck involved in this sport, isn't there?
Oh, yeah, it's all luck. You find the guy with the cheapest equipment can sometimes win, so yeah.
Righto, about 100 metres to go, we're turning left.
It's not long before the teams are on their way in search of the five hidden transmitters, which are hidden many kilometres apart. It's this night hunt which really brings out the teamwork needed for success. The driver keeps a careful eye on the roads and terrain as the beam turner calls the direction from which the signal is coming from.
10:30. All right, keep going straight across.
Left?
Left or right? Straight ahead, if that makes sense.
No, it doesn't.
Well, according to the map, it's a crossroad.
Bearings a little bit
wide. Don't go left. It'll be a right and then a left or something. We just can't see it. There you go.
The navigator then pulls all the information together to try and get the team to the fox using the most direct route. That's the theory, at least. Like in any sport, there's team rivalry, which means there's no amount of tricks and decoys to try to distract others who may be following close behind. GPS navigation is absolutely essential to pinpoint exactly where you are in the pitch-black South Australian pine forests. And to add an extra element of excitement to what is already an action-packed night, thick fog, with the consistency of a good pea soup, descends on the forest floor, making visual navigation almost impossible. The what seems like sub-zero environment also adds to the challenge of the Mount Gambier night hunt. After 2.5 hours, the first team successfully finds all five transmitters. But it's not until after midnight that all teams have completed the course. The night hunt never goes without some form of incident, and tonight was no different. One team managed to get well and truly bogged, and another just ran out of petrol.
So tell us what happened last night in the paddock out there where you got bogged.
It was tragic. We'd come through, we'd finished, we were going home, and then we'd already been through this little bog and back again, and we had to go through it again, and we decided to go a little bit too far to the right, and we should have gone that far to the right, but, well, we went a bit too far, and we got in a little bit tentative, and speed is of the essence when you come to travelling through bogs, and we didn't have enough of it, and a little application of brakes and that sort of...
So you had a sinking feeling, did you?
Yeah, only on one side. And getting out and having a look, yes, it has sunk. Highway road pressure in the tyres probably didn't assist that little thing, but anyway, it was a beautiful evening to sit out there and contemplate the evening, which we did.
How long were you out there before rescue arrived?
Oh, it'd be about 15 to 20 minutes. It would normally have been longer, but the rescue vehicle... is very fleet of foot.
And what was the conversation like in the vehicle in that 15 to 20 minutes?
It was sporadic, loud and in quiet, quite friendly. A few attempts made to jam pieces of wood under the wheels for traction and things like that, but to no avail.
Bruce, you ran out of petrol last night. What happened?
Basically that. We realised on about the second last hunt, our driver said, we seem to be getting a bit low on fuel. I didn't notice it at the start of a hunt. Anyway, well, we thought we'd keep going, and we had the yellow light go on about 10 minutes to go into the final leg. We thought, well, we're probably better off finding a fox and all the other people who have found it, and then we've got someone who can go and get fuel for us rather than trying to get home on our own. So we kept on persevering. We had all sorts of trouble with our equipment, so we couldn't get a good direction, but we finally found the fox, and we only went about 3 km past the fox going home, and we conked out.
So tell me a little bit about the conditions last night. It was mighty brisk.
Yes, it was, but it doesn't really matter in the car. You can have a heater going, and it's quite comfy.
Except when you run out of petrol.
Except, well, yes, it's true. When the windows just fog up.
The National Australian Fox Hunting Championships are certainly something to behold and to compete in. There are several local competitions run in various states around Australia on a regular basis. Most groups are actively seeking new members and teams. So if this sort of fun is for you, then why not give it a go? You'll need a vehicle of sorts, some amateur radio gear and a GPS. A zest for a bit of adventure is also mandatory. Contact your local amateur radio club for more details or the Wireless Institute of Australia. And the 2007 winner? Congratulations to Brian's team again for the third year in a row. I'm Andrew McComb for Tech Talk Radio.
So there you go. That was what we did on the weekend, boys.
Aren't
you
glad you had like a lot of fun?
Oh, look, the thing that amazes me, you can have all that technology and the and the petrol light comes on and there's not a cracker you can do about it.
It sounds like organised chaos, Andrew. People driving everywhere. You're yelling at people saying, go straight ahead. And they're going, no, we can't go straight ahead. And
it was a T-intersection.
It's a T.
Go straight ahead at the T-intersection.
It sounds like you worked it out, though.
Well, it's pitch black and your lights don't show you that there's a road slightly to the right about 30 metres over. You just can't
see
it.
And the fog,
it, you
know? And it's like, oh, there it is over there. So, you know, and then you run out of map because some of the maps are a little bit old, or there's a big black void on the right-hand side where it becomes Victoria, for example, and that's it. You just go, may the force be with you, young navigator, and off they go. But no, it was a lot of fun.
Nice chance to chat to Brian Ackerley, who we've had on before with the AA battery comparison.
That's right. Yes, that was Brian.
And Adam Scammell, who's talked about radio orienteering before.
Yep, they're all available downloads on the website if you want to know a little bit more about it. But if you want to come along one night, you know, and you've got that zest for enthusiasm, you would certainly be welcome, even if you come along as a passenger, just try and get in touch with some of these guys. Plenty of websites to do that, plenty of people to have a look, even through ours. There's a lovely photo of you, Mark, on the webpage there, putting up an antenna.
80-metre antenna.
Yeah, just in the foot of the... there's lovely trees in the background there. So go and have a look and you'll know exactly what we're talking
about. Funny story, just a quick one.
Yep.
One of the teams decided to use Google Earth Plus this year. On their, to do their tracking. So we
as
have
their
this
mapping software.
As their mapping software. So mm-hmm. we use things like Figawi and Aussie Explorer is another one. But
these are all software programs you can download off the internet.
And you know, you have topographic maps on them. Well, this team decided this year they'd try Google Earth. But you buy Google Earth Plus for about $20, $25 US, and then it will track on there. But you've got the satellite images, which is, you know, really good, show you actually where the tracks are in the pine forest a bit better. That was their theory. So they downloaded a gigabyte of maps because it all gets cached onto your PC.
Because you can.
Yeah, because you can. So they did that on the Thursday night, only to find that when they actually purchased Google Earth Plus, all of that gets scrapped. And they had nothing on their
Earth no.
Plus. So do you reckon this is fair use policy? They paid $10 for their internet connection at their hotel and downloaded 400 megabytes.
Yeah, that's fair use. It's all in the name of science, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
Very good.
So there you go, everybody. That's an abuse of technology, which is a lot of fun, and I highly recommend it to anybody, especially if you like getting out in the bush and playing with all that sort of stuff. It really is good fun. All right, moving right along.
Hang on, well, before you move on. Where did you guys come in the final results?
Oh, you want to know how we did? What did we got? Third out of 11th, didn't we, over the overall?
Oh, that's not too
fourth.
Bad.
Now we came fourth overall.
Did we?
Second
fourth.
On the night hunt, which we're absolutely chuffed about.
Yeah, that
we?
Was a bit of fun, that one.
Mm-hmm. And we got a couple of other firsts on other events. And, yep.
Yeah. Oh, congratulations.
There you go. So the Tech Talk Radio team did reasonably well over there.
Very good.
Come and join us next year. It'll be a lot of fun. I don't know who... you guys go and we'll stay here and do the show. No.
Yeah, all right. Deal. Yeah. Done.
Thank you to our driver, Greg Williams, who we've had on before as well as our legal representative.
Sounding a bit nepotistic now, isn't it?
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Tech Talk Radio wants your feedback. Call the Tech Talk Radio feedback line or visit our website and tell us your thoughts on the show. Tell us your likes and dislikes, your technical dilemmas and program suggestions. Call 1-300-664-882 and leave a voice message. That's 1-300-664-882 or visit our website, techtalkradio.com.au, and click on the feedback link.
You're listening.
Dr. Ron?
Here I am.
Residual power.
And I've got some residual power.
You can't turn off CDMA.
In terms of the volume,
over a centimeter. Fingerprints.
Now, this
we may have digressed.
Talk radio. Talk radio.
Bill Burgess also claimed the country would remain behind.
We used to think 600 kilometers.
Don't open things that are good that you're not expecting, even if they do a thing.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to the summer series of Tech Talk Radio. Adam Turner's a regular here on the Tech Talk Radio panel. As a journalist, he's a writer for the Melbourne Green Guide and the Melbourne Age, not to mention a few other publications and online services. Every week, Adam has a view on technology, and we call it a view from the couch. Adam Turner's View from the Couch on Tech Talk Radio.
This week, we've taken the couch on the road with a visit to the Seabed Australia Technology Show at Darling Harbour in Sydney. I've set myself the goal of visiting all 700 exhibition booths, even if it's just a drive-by glance. So let's go and see who we can find.
My name's Julie and I'm here for the Project Factory. The Project Factory are doing work inside Second Life, which is a virtual online virtual world, bit of a phenomenon. Project Factory are working inside Second Life, building a brand presence for organisations. We've built 11 islands for Big Pond, an island for the ABC, and we're talking to everyone here at CBIT about how important Second Life is and the virtual world is really happening.
And what sort of things are you building?
Well, we're building islands, a billabong pub, so people can come and interact, community stuff. There's swimming pools. They're really just a chance for the community inside Second Life, the individuals who actually create Second Life, to come in and socialise and be together. But it's also then that opportunity for the organisation to have a bit of a brand presence there as well.
There are over 700 exhibitors this year at CBIT, and they're expecting at least 30,000 visitors to come through over 3 days and have a look around to see what's the latest in technology.
My name's Darryl Knight. I'm the National Sales Manager at Internode. And what do we do? Well, we're a broadband services provider. We deliver services for home, small office, home office organisations, business, right through to corporate. So we cover the entire spectrum.
And so from the people coming to the stand so far, what is it that they're interested in?
Yeah, there's certainly a lot of interest in our ADSL 2 Plus services and broadband services in general, and also a lot of interest here this year in VoIP. And voice over IP is no longer a buzzword, it's a reality. And Internode launched its second version of its voice over IP product last week. We call it NodePhone, and NodePhone is going to allow our customers to make and receive calls at a fraction of the price that they'd normally be paying for them.
G'day, my name's Brad. I'm the retail sales manager for Netgear. We manufacture consumer networking products that basically help people in the home share everything from their internet to digital content to connecting computers together and share all the devices around their home.
So of the people coming to the stand, what are they interested in?
So a couple of really hot products, a lot of interest in. We've got a range of new power line networking products that use your home's electrical wiring to replace cables or possibly wireless around the home. We've got some wireless Skype phones that can help you make free Skype calls all over the world. Some new storage solutions that you can share your content and automatically back up all your files. We've got a new range of wireless and networking products that you know greatly improve on the old 54G wireless standard, and they're probably the hottest products at the moment.
Just about all the major areas of technology you can think of are represented here. You've got sections for wireless, VoIP, GPS, open source. It's really a chance to just wander the floor and check out what's new and exciting in technology. Now we've wandered into OpenCBIT, which is the open source section of the show.
Hi there, my name's Donna Benjamin. I'm with OSIA, which is the Open Source Industry Association for businesses delivering open source solutions. But open source is about more than business. It's about basically bringing freedom to your computer. Even if you're running Windows, you can run open source. You could run OpenOffice, which is a full suite of applications like a word processor and a spreadsheet and a presentation package. There's drawing as well. Or even Firefox, which is a great web browser, allows you to do tab browsing, and it's really safe and secure.
So what sort of interest have you had from people?
Having amazing interest. People are picking up Ubuntu CDs. Now, that's a live Linux CD. You can put that in your machine, boot off it, and experience Linux and open source software without having to install it on your computer. It's a really good way to get a first taste.
Okay, we're over talking to the people from the University of New South Wales BlueSat project.
All right. Hi, my name is Garth. I'm the telemetry system team leader of the project. So basically what we're here is to tell the public what the university actually gave us a chance to do, to build a microsatellite to be launched into space.
And what sort of things will the satellite do?
The satellite basically will join the ham amateur radio network.
So how will people on the ground be able to interact with it?
Well, if you're a regular hammer, we operate on two frequencies. It's an uplink frequency of 145 megahertz and a downlink frequency of 435 megahertz.
And what will you be able to do? Will you be able to talk to the satellite, or how will it work?
We're aiming to put a PackSat, which is a store and forward packet system, which operates similar to like a POP3 email account. So basically you can put your messages onto it, and when it passes over the location that needs to be downloaded, they can download off it again.
So it's basically like a voicemail box in space?
Yeah.
So there you go, whether you're trying to download videos from the internet or upload messages to a satellite, there's something for everyone at Seabit. And that's this week's View from the Couch.
Entertaining, informative and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Plasma TVs may be banned. Oh, my goodness.
I don't care. They will pry my plasma out of my cold, dead hand.
Microsoft issued 7 security patches in a regular update.
Yep, there's a debate as to whether by turning off the ads, you're effectively stealing the content.
What about the three of us? We can't give up our day jobs.
Yes, absolutely.
We could be the three amigos.
We could.
You're listening to Australia's most informative technology show, Tech Talk Radio.
You've been listening to the Tech Talk Radio Summer Series. We'll be back next week with the last in our Summer Series before we're all back in the studio for a fresh look at all the new technology and gadgets that supposedly make our lives just that little bit easier. Don't forget to visit the Tech Talk Radio website for all the information on past shows and feel free to drop us an email and say g'day. So that's it for Tech Talk Radio this week. Until next week, I'm Andrew McComb, and on behalf of everyone here at Tech Talk Radio, thanks for your company. Tech Talk Radio is brought to you each and every week by a band of dedicated professionals from within the broadcasting, IT and telecommunications industries. The team consists of executive producer and host Andrew McComb, producer Dr. Ron, panellists Graham Callaghan and Mark Diggins, expert opinion from Adam Turner, and our US correspondent is Lydia Davis. Production facilities courtesy of Evolving Communications, and podcast production by Graham Callaghan. Tech Talk Radio is broadcast, recorded and streamed live to the world each and every Monday night from 8 p.m. The crew wish to thank all the stations that take the show, including 3WBC, 3XX, Cairns FM, Highlands FM and Queer FM in Western Australia. Tech Talk Radio is available for syndication on your local station. For sponsorship and advertising, call 03 9018 9043 or visit the website techtalkradio.com.au for more information. This has been a production of Tech Talk Radio Vic and is subject to copyright and applicable laws and may not be rebroadcast without approval.
Entertaining, informative and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.